Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Solipsism and narcissism, a further examination of the rational and emotional machinations which enable white genocide. There's an old joke I wanted to tell to make an analogy, and when I went searching for an example to read here, I found that there's a name for it. It's called the streetlight effect. The joke goes like this. A policeman sees a drunk man searching for something under a streetlight and asks what the drunk has lost. He says he lost his keys, and they both look under the streetlight together. After a few minutes, the policeman asks if he is sure he lost them there, and the drunk replies, no, he lost them in the park. The policeman asks, why is he searching here? And the drunk replies, this is where the light is. As the Wikipedia article describes it, the streetlight effect is a type of observational bias where people search where it's easier to search rather than where it would be more fruitful. Over the course of the past year or so, I've laid out what I think has been a thorough and fairly stated critique of what others refer to as white pathology, and specifically what they call pathological altruism. The key point that I return to again and again is that there is a pathogen, an other, an enemy, the Jews. My criticism, to put it simply, is that much of what is labeled white pathology is a result of enemy action. In fact, I've gone farther and pointed out that if whites exhibit any behavior which could justifiably be called pathological, that is, symptomatic of a collective mental disease, then it would be how whites collectively fail to perceive Jews collectively as a mortal enemy. And this in spite of the Jews' relentless expressions of alienation and hostility, made most plain in the victim narrative that Jews never tire of recounting. In essence, the Jewish narrative portrays the Jews as entirely blameless and eternally oppressed by anti-Semites, which by their own telling includes every people they've ever come into contact with, but most recently is primarily whites. Their Holocaust narrative is the latest, most specific, most in-your-face example of this narrative. So in other words, Jews clearly see whites as their enemy. And you can hear from them more or less openly when they lecture everyone about this in their media and from their privileged perches in universities and corporations and government any day of the week. Yet even whites who have demonstrated some greater than average racial consciousness and even an awareness of the Jews seem prone to discount the impact of Jewish hostility, their influence, or both. Instead, they hypothesize some mysterious inborn defect in whites, some baked-in weakness that makes whites vulnerable, with the premise that it has nothing to do with the Jews. As I've pointed out, this desire to search within their own collective, to look where the light is best, so to speak, is itself, I think, a symptom of the very weakness they're looking for. It also seems to me there's a perfectly reasonable explanation for why this happens. The word for it is ethnocentrism, an anthropological term, which is the technical name for the view of things in which one's own group is the center of everything. This is the natural tendency of most groups of human beings, not just whites. There's another recurring theme, or to put it more bluntly, another elementary error, which occurs in many of the attempts to understand and explain collective behavior using terms that are ordinarily used to describe the motives and behaviors of individuals, using the term suicide instead of genocide is a good example of both of these mistakes, blotting out the Jews and personalizing the problem at the same time. The psychological term self-deception, as in Jewish self-deception, is another example. And I've argued that it should really just be called Jewish deception. The real self-deception is in the white individuals who misinterpret the persistent collective nature of Jewish lying. The error in using such individualistic terms is that it inevitably personifies and thus distorts the problem, even if only in the minds of listeners. The speaker may simply be grasping for words with a preference for familiar terms where there seems to be more light. But in my opinion, blunter language is ultimately more fruitful, even if we must invent or call in other terms so as not to misunderstand or misrepresent what is in truth a collective phenomena. A few months ago, I spoke about Stockholm Syndrome and gaslighting in a podcast titled Gaslighting. And I tried to address these errors and to offer some other psychological terms and concepts which I think better fit the relationship between Jews and whites. In particular, that it is a relationship and that it's an asymmetric, abusive, parasitic relationship in which the Jews benefit and whites are harmed. Just to refresh your memory about gaslighting, gaslighting is a form of mental abuse in which information is twisted or spun, selectively omitted to favor the abuser, or false information is presented with the intent of making victims doubt their own memory, perception, and sanity. The obvious analogy that I'm drawing here is the Jews and their Holocaust guilt tripping and their psychoanalytic theories of anti-Semitism as the mental abusers, the sociopathic liars who deny any wrongdoing. And the whites are the victims of this mental abuse and exhibit various white pathologies as a result. And I'll emphasize again right here that I'm drawing an analogy. It's not a perfect fit. For one thing, gaslighting ordinarily describes a relationship between two individuals, whereas the analogy I'm making is the relationship between whites and Jews collectively, even though within those collectives there are a broad spectrum of individual motives and attitudes. I think it fits pretty well. I think it's useful, this analogy, because it fits the most relevant and important aspect of the relationship between whites and Jews, the relatively conscious and yet lopsided relationship between white and Jew elites, the people who actually have some measure of power. Here's a bit more about these kinds of relationships, and it's specifically addressed to the point of anyone who says that what I'm doing here is presenting an argument that whites are blameless. And it comes from an article, it's a few paragraphs from an article titled, "When You Love Your Abuser, Stockholm Syndrome and Trauma Bonds." So far I've used the word victim to describe the women or men who suffer at the hands of psychopaths. Yet I don't really like this word for several reasons. It tends to imply a certain passivity, as if the woman herself had nothing to do with the decision to get involved with the psychopath, or worse yet, to stay with him even once his mask of sanity started to slip. It's rare that a psychopath physically coerces a woman to get involved with him or stay with him, although he intimidates and brainwashes her, generally the victim cooperates. So I think the analogy there to whites and Jews holds that there is something to be said for the point that whites continue to put up with this in spite of the fact that it's in our faces. Another paragraph from this same article. A victim of Stockholm syndrome irrationally clings to the notion that if only she tries hard enough and loves him unconditionally, the abuser will eventually see the light. He, in turn, encourages her false hope for as long as he desires to string her along. Seeing that he can sometimes behave well, the victim blames herself for the times when he mistreats her. Because her life has been reduced to one goal and one dimension which subsumes everything else, she dresses, works, cooks, and makes love in ways that please the psychopath. Her self-esteem becomes exclusively dependent upon his approval and hypersensitive to his disapproval. As we know, however, psychopaths and narcissists can't be pleased. Relationships with them are always about control, never about mutual love. Consequently, the more psychopaths get from their partners, the more they demand from them. The combination of Stockholm syndrome and cognitive dissonance produces a victim who firmly believes the relationship is not only acceptable, but also desperately needed for their survival. And that last bit there calls to mind the recent statements by Manuel Valls in France and Joe Biden in the U.S. concerning how absolutely essential they believe the Jews are to our societies and to our well-being, while describing all of these horrible, harmful consequences that they're responsible for. Solipsism. I've used the term solipsism several times in recent podcasts and comments on blog posts, and I wanted to define this term. I wanted to explain it in more detail and what I think about it. Solipsism comes from the Latin solus, meaning alone, and ipse, meaning self. It is the philosophical idea that only one's own mind is sure to exist. Metaphysical solipsism is the, quote, strongest, unquote, variety of solipsism. Based on a philosophy of subjective idealism, metaphysical solipsists maintain that the self is the only existing reality, and that all other reality, including the external world and other persons, are representations of that self and have no independent existence. So, first of all, this is one of these concepts about individuals that I pointed to when I started talking here. And so I realized that when I use the word solipsism in a racial sense, that I qualify it as racial solipsism, not as just plain old solipsism. But still, that's something to keep in mind, you know, when you about such terms, that such collective versus individual nature of what you're trying to describe needs to be kept in mind and ideally represented in the language that you use. That last bit, that last paragraph there that I read about there is no one, nobody else has any independent existence is another term I've seen used for this is that others lack agency. This either moral agency or just a plain old agency is expressing the same idea, that others aren't independent, don't make their own decisions, don't control their own actions. A little bit more here, skipping ahead in this article about solipsism, going into the history of the term. Georgias of Leontini. Solipsism was first recorded by the Greek pre-Socratic sophist Georgias, who is quoted, and this is, he lived in 483 to 375 BC, who is quoted by the Roman skeptic Sestus Empiricus as having stated, "Nothing exists. Even if something exists, nothing can be known about it. Even if something could be known about it, knowledge about it can't be communicated to others." Sounds like a real pessimist. Much of the point of the sophists was to show that, quote, objective, unquote, knowledge was a literal impossibility. The foundations of solipsism are in turn the foundations of the view that the individual's understanding of any and all psychological concepts, thinking, willing, perceiving, etc., is accomplished by making analogy with his or her own mental states, i.e. by abstraction from inner experience. And this view, or some variant of it, has been influential in philosophy since Descartes elevated the search for incontrovertible certainty to the status of the primary goal of epistemology, whilst also elevating epistemology to, quote, first philosophy, unquote. So this solipsism, I thought it was a relatively rare and unknown term, but it's at the core of philosophy. And I think it also wrapped up in here is Freud, Sigmund Freud's concept of projection, which I think there is something to, both negative projection and positive projection, where you imagine your own thinking processes, you project them into the minds of other people around you. You imagine that they are motivated and think as you do. In the case of negative projection, that's you project your negative thinking, your dishonest thoughts, your hostile thoughts onto your enemy. And in the case of positive projection, you imagine that everyone else is nice, just like you are, and thinks friendly thoughts, just like you do. So as I say, this concept of solipsism, it's not a good fit. It's not a perfect fit. With qualifications, you can see how it sort of fits some of what's happening, some of what's going on. But maybe it would be even better to call it a form of extreme ethnocentrism rather than solipsism, because ethnocentrism carries with it the implication that it's a collective that we're talking about. It's a collective behavior. And you could even call it pathological ethnocentrism. What I'm calling racial solipsism, this narrow-minded focus on your own people and only your own people to the point of ignoring enemies. Let's call that pathological ethnocentrism, to coin a phrase. But another term that comes to mind, we don't really have to coin our own terms for these things, one that reflects a European archetype originating in a European myth, and it also has to do with quote-unquote suicide, is the term narcissism. The archetype and the myth are named after Narcissus. Narcissus was a hunter from Thespiae in Boeotia who was known for his beauty. He was the son of the river god Sisyphus and nymph Lyriope. He was proud in that he disdained those who loved him. Nemesis noticed this behavior and attracted Narcissus to a pool where he saw his own reflection in the water and fell in love with it, not realizing it was merely his own image. Unable to leave the beauty of his reflection, Narcissus drowned. Narcissus is the origin of the term narcissism, a fixation with oneself. So what we see described here, and I think what most people understand about narcissism, whether or not they know more details about the myth, is this idea of an unhealthy self-attraction, self-infatuation. What probably many people don't realize is the role of nemesis or the other in this myth, and that it is the other that exploits this self-attraction, self-infatuation, and makes it fatal. Multiple versions of this myth have survived from ancient sources. The classic version is by Ovid, found in Book 3 of his Metamorphoses, completed in 8 AD. This is the story of Narcissus and Echo. One day, Narcissus was walking in the woods when Echo, an Oread, a mountain nymph, saw him, fell deeply in love, and followed him. Narcissus sensed that he was being followed and shouted, "Who's there?" Echo repeated, "Who's there?" She eventually revealed her identity and attempted to embrace him. He stepped away and told her to leave him alone. She was heartbroken and spent the rest of her life in lonely glens until nothing but an echo sound remained of her. Nemesis, the goddess of revenge, learned of this story and decided to punish Narcissus. She lured him to a pool where he saw his own reflection. He didn't realize it was only an image and fell in love with it. He eventually realized that his love could not be addressed and committed suicide. Again, we see the other plays a key role in this myth, in this version of the myth. And in this case, we've got one gaslighting other that simply echoes him, probably driving him nuts, and a vengeful other who comes across as a feminist, a vengeful feminist. There are other versions of this myth. All of them end in the death of Narcissus. And there's a moral to that story, and that's the moral